The president's helicopter was raring to go when the ABC's John Lyons asked Trump a model question, direct and loaded.
That is it appropriate, President Trump, that a president in office should be engaged in so much business activity?
Well, I'm really not. My kids are running the business.
But
I'm
you
here.
Are also...
You know what the activity... Where are you from?
I'm from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Four Corners Program.
The Australians, you're hurting Australia right... In my opinion, you are hurting Australia very much right now. And they want to get along with me. You know, your leader is coming over to see me very soon.
President
I'm going
Trump,
to tell him about you. You set a very bad tone.
Well,
go ahead,
President
John.
Trump, okay, when the UAE does a deal like that,
you can set a nicer
when the UAE
tone.
Does a deal, what does it want in return?
Quiet.
That exchange was reported around the world, but nothing changed. In the months since, the Trump family has rapidly expanded its business interests across the Gulf, especially in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. These deals aren't typical business ventures. On the Gulf side, business and state interests are tightly intertwined. On the other is the family of the President of the United States. The underlying logic is plain. Be kind to the Trumps, and the United States will be kind to you. Trump argues he's out of it. His wealth sits in a trust administered by his children. They do the deals. But the income flows to Big Daddy as it always has. And if he ever steps down from office, all the wealth will be waiting for him to play with. Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative journalist Eric Lipton has been following Trump's business interests in the Gulf region for over a decade. He joins me now from Washington. Eric, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Do you know the answer to the question that John Lyons was putting to the president, how much wealth he's amassed since returning to office?
Well, you know, most of it depends on the crypto markets, and they've been down a bit. But, I mean, it's clearly over $1 billion. He has, you know, kind of his wealth has grown more rapidly than really at any time in his career, starting as a young real estate executive in New York. Because crypto and money coming to his family companies from people who have, you know, foreign policy matters before him.
Isn't there something in the U.S. Constitution that sort of suggests that the President of the United States cannot deal financially with foreign powers?
I mean, there is a clause in the Constitution that's known as the Emoluments Clause that says that the president should not accept, you know, gifts and other compensation from foreign governments. In Trump's first term, there were, you know, three or four different lawsuits, you know, that went through the process of asserting that even when the Saudis, for example, stayed at the Trump Hotel in D.C., which he used to own, that that was a violation of the Emoluments Clause. Ultimately, the clock ran out on those lawsuits, and they were deemed moot when he left office at the end of his first term. And those suits have not been refiled. And one of the issues, I think, is even if there had been a ruling by the Supreme Court that he was in violation of the Emoluments Clause, it was a civil matter. There wasn't really much of a resolution that would have occurred.
Yeah.
No one has refiled those lawsuits. I mean, it also, I think there's a perception that the courts are stacked at this point, and the Supreme Court would probably, you know, rule in favor of the president. So there has not been an ultimate adjudication as to whether or not the business operations run by his sons that financially benefit him represent a violation of the Constitutional Emoluments Clause. It's still modestly an open question, but, you know, perception-wise, it does appear to be a conflict of interest. And there has been, you know, very much less concern about the appearance of a conflict of interest in the second term compared to the first term by the president and his family.
Before he was re-inaugurated, he issued a formal statement to say that the Trump Organization, the business end of things, would have no new transactions with foreign governments. Now, has he stuck by that, or has his business end stuck by that?
No, it hasn't. I could think of immediately, you know, two examples. I mean, in Qatar, they're doing a real estate project including a golf course that is with the government there. And then most importantly, in the United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, you know, a sovereign fund-backed government entity transferred $2 billion to the Trump-affiliated World Liberty Financial, and that also made it a direct investment in World Liberty, worth, I think, $500 million. So that those are both were government entities, and so therefore, no, they have not honored that assertion. And they not only are doing business with foreign entities, but they're doing business with foreign government entities in this second term.
Let's look to the pattern of these deals. It seems that the Trumps put up no money. They put up their name and other people put up money. They seem to be extraordinary business arrangements.
Yeah, I mean, dating back to before Trump ran for the first president for the first time, I mean, really in the post-Apprentice period, Trump realized that really the thing he had of most value was his brand, because, you know, through Apprentice, before he first ran for president, he had really built a kind of a global perception of someone who was kind of able to make wealth. Although, of course, you know, he has a history of bankruptcy and had been kind of, you know, not massively successful, of mixed success, you could say. But they realized that this brand was worth something, and so they started to sell the name to people that were doing real estate projects around the world, and mostly on the luxury end, with the belief that if you had a Trump brand associated with a project, the sellers of those condos or office space could get a premium on the sale price, and a cut of that premium would go to the Trump family. And so typically they would get paid an upfront fee of, you know, millions of dollars, and then they would get a small percentage of the sales of the units based on whether or not they went at an above market price. And so that was something that they were doing before the president went in for his first term. And they did, in fact, stop those deals during Trump's first term. They did not do new deals during his first term. And they said they wouldn't, and they didn't. But then at the start of the second term, they made it clear that they were not going to abide by that same standard, and that they were not going to hesitate to do new deals, international deals, because they felt like they were beat up anyway during the first term when they were investigated and harassed from their perspective. So they've continued to do new international deals, and not only new ones, but new international deals with foreign governments in the second term. And yeah, they're built upon them simply being paid for his name. The Trump family does play a role in when they agree to do, for example, a new Trump golf course. The Trump family reviews the design for that golf course, and it tries to make sure that it's built to a certain standard. And, you know, I've been to a bunch of Trump hotels and Trump golf courses around the world, and they actually are generally quite well run, and they are attractive facilities. And so they do essentially set a standard for their brand, just sort of like Marriott hotels. I mean, Marriott doesn't own most of its hotels around the world. It sells its brand, and then it demands that the owner of that hotel meet the Marriott expectations.
I don't know, but it doesn't seem to me that the Gulf's much of a place to play golf right now. How much of this business investment has he put at risk by starting this war?
No question that they really, you know, their biggest source of revenue, and it's not only the Trump sons, but even Jared Kushner, who, you know, raised more than $4 million in capital, mostly from Middle East sovereign wealth funds when he left the first Trump administration. And now he's both a private equity executive and as a Middle East envoy, effectively, for the president simultaneously. But the bulk of their new wealth has come from the Middle East. And that's, I mean, to some extent, that's reflective of the transition that's gone on prior to this most recent Iran war, where the Middle East has become, you know, increasingly they're putting their oil wealth to become, kind of huge sources of capital for the technology industry and for, you know, venture capital firms globally. And so the Trumps saw that this was a huge source of capital, and they turned to them. But yes, they have put an enormous amount of their focus on the Middle East. They have, you know, 8 different projects pending with this one company called Dar Global, which was, you know, essentially an affiliate of Dar Al Arkan, a Saudi real estate company. And there are more projects being done with Dar Global than any other company in the world. And, you know, most of those projects are in the Middle East. They're in Oman, in Dubai, and in Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, and then there's one in the Maldives. And each of those are branding projects where the Trump name is being put onto a tower or a golf course. And they're making tens of millions of dollars from that. And the truth of the matter is that they are hurting. Trump's move in Iran has massively destabilized the Middle East, and it's left open questions about, just how safe is Dubai, how safe is the rest of the UAE and some of the, and also, Doha and some of these other places. And so the future prospects of their businesses are to some extent in question at the moment. But that's a short-term thing. I mean, they're still getting paid their branding fees.
Yeah. But I suppose there could be an argument, Eric, that this is proof of that this man stands above his own business dealings and is looking to the interests of the world by having this war, despite the damage it's going to do to his golf courses. But look, let's not go down that track. I am curious, Eric, are his sons and sons-in-law any good at business?
I mean, I know all of his three oldest. I mean, his Don Jr. and Eric and Jared. I know each of them. I've known each of them for some time. But there's a Saturday Night Live version of Don Jr. and Eric, as adults. I find they're quite different as individuals. They've been quite successful, and Don Jr. is promoting a broader range of things. He's got a podcast. He's got he's now at a venture capital firm called 1789. He's got a much more varied interest. And Eric is the primary son that's running the Trump Organization and the crypto ventures that they've created. I think they're reasonably successful business people. I think that even that in their own right they probably would be reasonably successful as business people without their dad, and Jared as well. Jared has proven ultimately at this point his venture capital firm has gotten a pretty decent return on the money that he got from the sovereign wealth fund. So I think that it's a bit of a stereotype to suggest that they're kind of like dolts that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yes, a very easy way of looking at it. But from your close reading over the years of these deals, particularly since Trump was inaugurated for the second time, are Trump's fingerprints all over this, or is it really his children who are doing these deals?
I think that like there was one point where there was a microphone that was, that was running where Trump was speaking with a leader, and there was some modest deal talk going on. And you ask the sons, and they say that they don't talk to their dad about the deals. But Trump is definitely the president is keeping track of these transactions, and I think he's quite aware of what his sons are doing. And I there is some evidence to suggest that some of these deals initiate with conversations with him and then they get passed off to the sons. Yep. I mean, the thing that we have focused the most on since he returned to office a second time is just the massive conflict of interest between him appointing the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission and him setting federal policy around cryptocurrency at the same time as his sons are like now run one of the largest stable coins in the world through World Liberty Financial, along with their other partners. And they are a massive beneficiary of the relaxation of federal policy around the cryptocurrency industry, although crypto's has been in a dive, since late last year. Just the fact that he is both setting the policy and then benefiting from those same changes is unlike anything we've seen in modern American history, where a president has such a direct financial interest in the people that he's appointing and in the policies that he's creating. And this is the single biggest source of his wealth. Dating all the way back to his early days as a real estate executive, there's never been anything like this. The scale of wealth that has come on just in the last year. So that's like a conflict of interest that just really has no precedent in modern American history, and he doesn't really have a good answer for it, why that's acceptable.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the New York Times reporter Eric Lipton, who has been covering for years now the story of Trump's wealth and his business dealings, particularly in the Gulf. Eric, crypto, explain. This came from nowhere. I mean, this is a man who's run gambling casinos, he tried to run a university, he runs golf courses, et cetera, et cetera. And then now it was crypto. When did this start? What got him into it? How successful has he been?
I mean, Trump was a very public skeptic of crypto and, you know, mocking it and suggesting that it was a financial system used by drug dealers and cheats. But then, you know, it was just in the last 5 or so years that they became huge advocates of it and huge investors and huge beneficiaries. And I mean, if you listen to his sons, the thing that they offer as the explanation as to why they became enthusiasts of crypto is that they argue that after January 6th, you know, at the end of his first term, when there were the riots that, you know, Trump instigated in D.C., they were, you know, they lost a lot of their banking relationships. And that's true. I mean, and some of the major banks did stop doing business with the Trump family. And so they, you know, this is their version as to why they became crypto enthusiasts, that they themselves witnessed what it's like to not be able to borrow money or to do transactions with large financial institutions. And that's when they began to look at crypto, which to some extent is set up as a financial system outside of Wall Street. And that's when they began to develop relationships with some of the people who said, look what these banks do to you. And that's that the timing does relatively fit. Eric Trump became friends with Michael Saylor, who was a huge investor in Bitcoin, is essentially tried to replicate some of the things that Michael Saylor has done. So, you know, I think that the crypto play is something that is driven by the sons, and then the fact that the dad became a huge crypto enthusiast is to some extent reflects the fact politically that he recognized that this was a constituency that if he would endorse cryptocurrency and the pulling back of regulation and the oversight and the aggressive approach that the Biden administration had taken, that Trump is very smart politically, that was a constituency that he could bring on for his reelection. And so he promised to become like the crypto president and to take a much lighter touch. And he did that. And so I think that it was his sons that were to that space and realizing that money could be made there and telling their dad about something he probably didn't really understand. But then him recognizing that this was a constituency of voters in the United States, you know, that he could bring on, just like he recognized that the vape people who were into vaping were a constituency that he could bring on if he was really to the position that supported them. It was a crass political observation and he ended up getting a massive amount of money.